This is the second session of the interview with John Ferry. It's now the 29th of October. So we must be getting you back to graduate school in the beginning of your...
Well, I'm now in England working at the National Institute for Medical Research with this very curious arrangement, doing something that normally people would do after they receive their PhD degrees. In England, I was impressed by the small size and of the scientific community, and the fact that people were rather closely knit. Everyone knew everyone else because of the small size of the country, and by going to an occasional scientific meeting, one would see famous people whom one had read about in textbooks. It was very impressive.
So this wasn't just chemists, but
I'm talking mostly about chemistry. My boss was, of course, a chemist, but the laboratory was primarily a medical laboratory. So there were, I would say that by far the majority of the professional staff were MDs and doing experiments with animals, physiology and bacteriology, which I didn't pay much attention to. Could you turn it off for a moment? I'll say a word about life in London, which was extremely stimulating. I explored the metropolis thoroughly and absorbed history, architecture, art, went to the theater a great deal, and everything was very cheap. For the equivalent of 50 cents, one could have a ticket to the theater or ballet. And I went to public lectures by famous people like Bertrand Russell and Gilbert Murray, the classicist. I lived at a so-called private hotel, which itself was extremely interesting because of the mix of people who lived there. Some were permanent residents, others were colonials on leave. The people in the colonies usually had 6 months leave interspersed with their tours of duty, people visiting from foreign countries, some young unmarried men and women who had various jobs, I could expand on this for a long time, but it's really irrelevant to a scientific story. I, in the end, stayed with this job for a year and a half, and there were several publications resulting from the work. I could have obtained a master's degree from the University of London by staying another 3 months, but I preferred to spend those months traveling around the continent, which was a very interesting experience. I alternated in my identity, occasionally putting on respectable clothes and visiting a scientific laboratory, and other times staying in youth hostels and traveling with a backpack. I might remark that in those days, a student was very well treated. He could go through customs with no problem at all, quite a contrast to the to much later days when students were always suspect. So I returned to the U.S. in June of 1934, and the original intent of the Rockefeller Foundation in sending someone over to work on ultrafiltration and membranes was to have this technique introduced into the United States, and of course I wasn't in a position to do that. I wasn't going to continue work on this particular subject. I was going back to graduate school. But I did write a long review for Chemical Reviews on the subject, which, well, when printed, it was about a quarter of an inch thick. And I felt that discharged my responsibility to some extent.
Did you go and see the people? This was Rockefeller Foundation, is that right?
Yes. Most of my friends said that I shouldn't consider that I really had any responsibility at all. It's true under the circumstances. I simply wasn't in a position to accept such responsibility. During my last months in London, I corresponded with universities and applied for fellowships, and I had very good fellowship offers from Princeton, Caltech, and Stanford. It would have been better for me, perhaps, to go to one of the first two, but I felt that if I went back to Stanford, well, I knew that if I went back to Stanford, I could finish my degree more quickly, because everybody knew me, and I already had one quarter of graduate work on the books, which represented the end of my what would have been my senior year at Stanford.
What do you mean would have been better for you at Caltech or Princeton?
Well, I would have had different experience and seen a different scientific environment, different faculty. It's always better for a person to have his education in two or more places rather than just one. However, if I'd done that, I probably never would have gone into polymers. So there is no use speculating about alternatives. Well, I would have had the opportunity of doing my PhD work either with Professor McBain, the rather pompous man who had sent me to England, or with Professor George Parks, with whom I had done my undergraduate research. Mm-hmm. And I preferred to go back and work with Parks. He had been interested for many years in the physical chemistry of the formation of glass. And that doesn't necessarily mean window glass, but other much simpler substances, such as glucose, will form glasses when cooled from the liquid state instead of crystals. In fact, as Parks was fond of pointing out, ordinary hard candy is glucose glass. All the materials which he'd been investigating were substances of low molecular weight. By low, I mean non-polymeric. Polymers have molecular weights in the thousands or millions. He had obtained a sample of a polymer, polyisobutylene, a laboratory curiosity in those days, and he suggested that we investigate this to see whether it would form a glass. Mm-hmm. And it did, and in the course of my measurements, I encountered the phenomenon of viscoelasticity, that is mechanical behavior, which is intermediate between that of viscous liquids and elastic solids. And that really started me off on the work which I've been doing ever since.
Because that was a new observation, was
that
it?
That was, well, you could find traces of it in the literature. Mm. It wasn't brand new, but it was something that really very few people had paid any attention to.
Can you remember how you did you use the word you didn't say discovered, but
no. I encountered.
Encountered. That's
yes.
Right. Could you describe that?
Well, I was trying to measure viscosity, and because in the course of studying the process of glass formation, Parks and his former students had shown that all the liquids like glucose or glycerol is another glycerin. You cannot crystallize glycerin, at least without a great deal of trouble. If you cool it, it forms a glass instead of forming crystals as most materials do. He had found, and I guess, well, others had too, that the viscosity increases enormously as the glass temperature is approached. And so that was one of the things I wanted to measure. A friend who had received his degree with Parks a couple of years before, named Monroe Spate, who later became president of the Shell Chemical Corporation, told me that I might find some curious elastic effects when I tried to measure the viscosity. He'd done some work on boron trioxide, which meant that he was working in a very different temperature range. Boron trioxide forms a glass at hundreds of degrees centigrade, very, very hot, whereas the material which I was working with forms a glass at 100 degrees below zero. So I was working in a very different temperature range. Well, sure enough, I found that as I started to measure the viscosity and the kind of apparatus that I used involved a rod, a very common kind of device for viscosity measurements, a rod immersed in a tube with the liquid filling the space between the rod and the tube, and then you put on a torque which turns the rod and see how fast it turns. If you do this with a liquid, when you put on the torque, it just starts turning at a constant rate, and that rate is inversely proportional to the viscosity. But viscoelastic materials have quite a different response. When you put on the torque, there is first a large and rather gradual elastic deformation, which is recoverable if you remove the torque, then it untwists again. But then if you wait long enough, leave the torque on, eventually it settles down to a steady rate of rotation, and that'll give you the viscosity. But you get a lot more out of this experiment because you get an elastic response as well.
Who devised this method of measuring?
The idea of a rod in a cylindrical tube probably went back 50 years. Other people had mm-hmm. measured viscosity in this manner.
And how your discussion with Spate was he a postdoc there?
Not at
how
the time.
How did you happen to be discussing it?
Well, I'd known Speight for a long time. He was 2 years ahead of me at Stanford as an undergraduate. Mm-hmm. He was a teaching assistant in one course that that I took, and when he went to Europe, he also went to Europe after his bachelor's degree, and worked with a very famous physical chemist, Peter Debye, and we had quite a correspondence while he was in Europe. He was a close friend, and it was quite natural that we should discuss the research that he had done and the research that I was about to do. It was really just a casual remark of his this was something that I might find interesting.
Is it a question of interest as to your response to the suggestion of Parks that you work on this particular project? Were you keen about it?
Well,
this was your PhD. Yeah,
this was going to be my
dissertation
PhD
work.
I wasn't terribly excited about it. In fact, as my story develops, it'll become evident that I jumped around for a number of years back and forth between one kind of study and another.
Oh.
And it really wasn't until I came here to Wisconsin at the age of 33, I guess, that I knew exactly what I wanted to do and was ready and excited about a series of investigations. So I really, for quite a few years, felt my way back and forth among various things that interested me, but not with an absolutely consuming interest, perhaps.
Did this disturb you?
Yes, it did sometimes. It was rather paradoxical in that I started out very rapidly graduating from Stanford, actually just before the age of 20, but then it took me a long time after that to settle down to a specific goal.
Yeah.
I remember, in fact, discussing this with an older friend who was doing some very successful work. He'd had his PhD for 2 or 3 years, and he said, after all, a ship's captain, when he starts crossing the ocean, doesn't worry about the harbor he's eventually bound for quite a long time. So
it's a steer in that general direction.
Yes, that cheered me up to some extent.
But was this because of the kind of person Parks was, maybe?
Well, he was not a particularly inspiring person. He was working in a little corner of physical chemistry and turning out some very important, accurate data, but he wasn't solving any pressing problems, any exciting problems.
So you really did set yourself back, didn't you, in a way, by going to Stanford?
Well, it's true. If I'd gone to Caltech, I might have worked with Linus Pauling, who got the Nobel Prize twice and was and certainly was one of the most important chemists of the 20th century. But I wasn't very excited about the things he was doing.
I see. That was a factor in your decision.
Oh, yes, yes. If I'd gone to Princeton, I might have got into polymers because Henry Eyring was had some interest in polymers among many other kinds of physical chemistry. Henry Eyring, by the way, was Joseph Hirschfelder's mentor at Princeton. And one of his students, a man named Arthur Tobolsky, did go into viscoelasticity, although he called it elastoviscosity, after the war.
And I remember seeing his name.
He and I were friendly competitors in some respect for a number of years. But that really is beside the point.
Yes, yes.
Now, where were we?
You were talking about the experiment and,
yes.
and your observation.
Yes.
Your encounter.
In the end, we published two papers, both of which I think were landmarks in a certain sense. Mm. One was the first thorough investigation of glass formation by a synthetic polymer, although someone at the Bureau of Standards had done some similar work on natural rubber, published a year before, with very similar results. Rubber is a molecule that's very similar to synthetic polymers, though it happens to be made biologically by the rubber tree.
You wrote the papers yourself.
Oh,
did
yes,
you?
Yes. Okay. I wrote the papers both of our work of my work in England and also the work of my PhD mm-hmm. work mm-hmm. and I've written.
So the "we" is the politeness given to the major professor.
Well, I suppose so, but people in other fields in science don't often realize what a close collaboration is involved in scientific work. In some fields, the professor, I suppose in English or history, will give the student a problem, and the student goes off and works for several months. But the professor in science talks with his student at least every week and perhaps every day and works along with him. That's the normal case. I must say that when I did my PhD work with Parks, I did only talk with him once a month or so. He left me pretty much on my own for this work.
Yes, as I understand it, that is unusual.
Yes. I've always written our papers when our afterwards referred to students plus myself. It's been a little selfish of me, perhaps, to do all the writing, except it was only in rare cases that I let a student do the writing, because to some extent it deprived them of the writing experience, but it's so much more efficient for me to set something down exactly the way I want it than it is to have somebody else do it and then chop it up and rearrange it the way I think it should have been done in the first place. On the other hand, following this line of thought a little more, I have always taken a great deal of pains with the students' theses when the thesis is the student's writing experience, has been in my laboratory, and And I've always gone over the thesis again and again, and helped the student develop his writing skills.
I do wonder if your training in languages, your education generally, made you much more write much more easily than many of your colleagues and your students.
I think that's true.
Very much more.
I can remember, even in England, just after I had my bachelor's degree and went over there, I heard people at lunch muttering about what a chore it was to write papers and how they wished they could get somebody else to do it for them and so on. And I thought that was a little strange, because I liked to write papers.
You always did, and you do still.
Oh yes, yes. I find it's an effort to get everything organized, but I thoroughly enjoy writing papers, and I'm quite fussy about grammar and style. And in fact, I've had arguments with copy editors when a scientific paper is sent in. It's turned over to someone to check the English, someone who generally doesn't know much about the subject matter.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes they have made changes that actually introduce grammatical mistakes.
which, quite maddening, isn't it?
Which has made me furious. And in fact, I had a rubber stamp made on one occasion, and I stamped all the reprints with a little statement: text altered by editor over author's protest. Well,
you want to share that stamp.
Yes. Do you want to shut it off for a minute while I collect?
Ask you one question about that. Did you develop habits of research at that time under Parks that you have followed, or have you developed them later?
Well, I think that with Parks I absorbed the philosophy that one should make measurements as accurately as possible. And this, in later years, led to a philosophy which I've stated a number of times, and that is that if one is seeking to answer a particular question, one should make experiments not just accurate enough to answer that question, but much more accurate if possible. And then my traditional statement is you will hopefully — that's the wrong use of hopefully now that we're talking about grammar — but you will hope to not only to answer the question, but to discover something entirely new. And that has repeatedly happened. I have read statements about scientific philosophy along the following lines: that if you are trying to decide between two hypotheses, for example, suppose you are interested in a particular property which depends on the concentration of a solution, and you want to know whether it is proportional to the first power of the concentration or the square of the concentration, you could make some rather crude measurements and decide. And that's the way some people think research should be done. But I would maintain that you should make measurements very, very carefully, and then you will probably discover a new phenomenon. And We've always tried to make measurements as carefully as we could, and we've always tried to develop new experimental methods to improve the accuracy, and the success has been largely due to the ingenuity of my students rather than myself. But
you say some people would defend that other approach because it would be quicker.
And they would consider that it's a waste of time and money to try to do something exceedingly accurate. Mm-hmm. If it isn't immediately necessary. Shall I continue?
Yes.
In June or early spring 1935, I was about to receive my PhD degree. It was in the depths of the Depression. There were very few jobs in industry, and I didn't want to go into industry anyway. I applied.
Why not?
Pardon?
Why not?
Well, because there was very little basic science in industry in those days. The General Electric Company was supposed to have a laboratory where basic science was done. I think at that time that was about the only place in the country, and it didn't last. It lasted for a couple of decades, maybe. Later on, Bell Telephone Laboratories became a place where basic science was done, but most industrial research was very empirical and oriented toward short-range goals. Mm-hmm. I applied for a couple of quite unattractive academic jobs without success. In the spring, I had met a retired rubber chemist named David Spence, who had rented a laboratory at the Hopkins Marine Station at Pacific Grove, California. That's a branch of Stanford University, and it was a small marine laboratory devoted mostly to marine biology. There was a little work on oceanography, but of a very primitive kind. Spence, as is described in one of the papers which I gave you, had been director of research at the Goodrich Rubber Company, tire and rubber company, and had retired quite wealthy, built a home on the 17-mile drive on the Monterey Peninsula, and decided that he didn't like a life of retirement, so he rented a small laboratory at the Marine Station and started doing some experiments on rubber chemistry. And he got so interested that he obtained a small grant from the Goodrich Company to hire an assistant. And in the end, I became that assistant. So here I was launched on another crazy interlude, in a sense, from a normal scientific career. I worked with him for a year. We did some quite interesting experiments on what would now be called the cross-linking of rubber, joining the linear rubber chain molecules into a network structure by chemical bonds which cross-link them here and there, so that what is first a collection of long, flexible, snake-like molecules simply entwined among each other becomes a permanent mesh network. Mm-hmm. And That is indeed the process of vulcanization, which is essential for forming rubber products for technological use. But the process was not very well understood at the time. In fact, we were working in the dark to a great extent. So this did not contribute, this year didn't contribute very much to my scientific experience.
Did it interest you?
It interested me to some degree, but I wasn't terribly excited about it. But I did learn more about polymers because, as I remarked before, rubber is quite similar to the synthetic polymers, which were a scientific curiosity in those days, but soon after developed into an enormous industry. I learned a lot about the history of rubber technology from Spence. He was a Scotsman. He had been lured to Akron, Ohio, from Great Britain back 1900 and something, around 1905, I guess, and was and participated in the first discovery and use of vulcanization accelerators, chemicals which catalyzed the vulcanization process and completely revolutionized rubber technology back in from around 1905 to 1910. So he had lots of stories to tell about this as we had tea every afternoon in his office with shortbread that he imported from Scotland. His father had been a professor of philosophy at the University of Aberdeen. Well, and he'd received his PhD in Germany, and I knew German quite well, so and all the polymer, a lot of the rubber literature was in German. We used German scientific terms half the time in our discussions because that was that was the vocabulary that we were reading in the literature. The environment, of course, was not at all intellectual, living on the Monterey Peninsula, but it was very pleasant. Another man who was a graduate student and I rented a small log cabin where we cooked some of our own meals, and don't want to go into personal details too much, but just as an aside, I might say that I learned to ride horseback because I thought it would be good for me, not because I really enjoyed it. I realized that I was in a blind alley, of course, and I wanted to get out, although Spence would have been glad to keep me on for another year. A cousin of my father's was a professor at Harvard, a professor of biochemistry, and master of Winthrop House. The Harvard houses were established, I think, in the 1920s. As introduce a system somewhat similar to the colleges of Oxford and Cambridge, and my father's cousin as master of Winthrop House. His career was much more a housemaster than mm-hmm. a biochemist, but I had met him on my way back from England in the spring of 1934. I visited a lot of relatives and friends as I worked my way back to home, which was then in Oregon. And I had visited Boston and met him. I wrote to him asking if there were fellowship opportunities, some kind of fellowship at Harvard. I was also, I guess, applying for some other possible positions. And as a result, I was offered a half-time position as instructor and tutor in biochemical sciences at Harvard. It might be worth saying something about the tutorial system. At the time the houses were established, another feature resembling education at Oxford and Cambridge was introduced, namely the tutorial system, which involved undergraduates spending an hour or two each week in one-to-one consultation with a tutor who might be a professor or a younger man, the equivalent of what's now known as a postdoctoral associate. When this was established, the chemistry department rejected it. They apparently felt that the laboratory instruction in chemistry provided enough personal contact so that tutors were not necessary in chemistry. So President Lowell, Abbott Lawrence Lowell, who was the person who established both the houses and the tutorial system, used the money which had been budgeted for chemistry to set up something called biochemical sciences, in which there was no department, but there was a staff of tutors. And, people could get their degrees in biochemical sciences, taking courses in chemistry, physics, biology, and other things. And as you might expect, most of the students were pre-medical. Mm-hmm. So I had a half-time position with 15 tutees, I'd never had any courses in biology or physiology, but it wasn't very difficult to work up the necessary background for this. And I became a resident tutor in one of the houses, which meant that I had my lodging and most of my meals free there. And but that was hardly enough to live on. So I was assured that I could probably get a part-time research appointment in some laboratory. The laboratory in which I ended up was the so-called Department of Physical Chemistry at the medical school, which was a very curious department in a way, because it dealt with physical chemistry of biological materials, a subject that in those days had ordinarily had no contact with medicine at all. It was the only department of physical chemistry in any medical school, and the people there were not involved in teaching medical students, although they did have places for senior medical students to do part-time research, and also people with MDs who wanted to do a combination of medicine and basic science would come into this department and work for a year or two. My cousin, Dr. Ronald Ferry, whom I mentioned before, was a member of this department, and its head was a man named Edwin J. Cohn, who was a very remarkable individual. I think it's fair to say that he was more of an entrepreneur than a scientist. He recognized important avenues of research, and he recognized brilliant people, and he had many friends who were much better scientists than he was, and relied on them for advice and detailed knowledge. Later on, he became very famous because of the large enterprise that he built up during the war years, of which I was also a part. But at that time, it was a rather small enterprise, and he was interested in developing the physical chemistry of proteins. He had spent a number of years working on amino acids, which are the building blocks of proteins. Proteins are polymers, in a sense. Mm-hmm. They're because a protein is built up of 100 or several hundred amino acids, which are joined together in a long chain, much as synthetic polymers are long chains, but usually a chain containing hundreds of the identical building block, whereas in proteins there are different building blocks. And of course, now we know a great deal more about that than we did in those days. I had turned the circle around in a way because I'd been working on proteins in England. Mm-hmm. Then I worked with synthetic polymers and rubber. Now I'm back to proteins again, and a little later on I'll be going back to synthetic polymers and rubber. So I'm the wheel is turning around and around in this respect.
Did he take you on because of your work in
London?
In London?
The fact that I'd worked on proteins in London was of considerable interest to him. And he didn't care anything about polymers or rubber.
Yeah.
But
I mean, he didn't just take you on as a courtesy to your...
Oh, no. Oh, absolutely not. In fact, my cousin, who was a very meticulous person, explained to Professor Cohn that he could not vouch in any way for my scientific competence. Cohn told me this.
Incidentally, what was the reputation of your dissertation? I mean, had you made a name for yourself with it?
No. No one paid any attention to it whatever. In later years, it was recognized as very early work in a field that later became popular, but it wasn't noticed in the slightest at the time.
But it did have its importance, but that only came out later.
Yes, I would say so. Mm-hmm. Yes.
So as far as this is Dr. Cohn is concerned, you were somebody who needing a job who worked on proteins.
That's right. Yes. Mm-hmm. He gave me a third time appointment to begin with. So I had a 5/6 appointment as instructor and was I called research associate? I think I was. Mm-hmm. And I traveled back and forth then on the subway between Cambridge, where I lived in Harvard College, and the medical school, which is in Boston, about 3 miles away. I was apprenticed, in a sense, in Dr. Cohn's laboratory to a man named J.L. Onkley, who was a physical chemist who'd received his Ph.D. with Professor William Teare.
Oh.
He had gone to MIT. In fact, at that time, he was on the MIT faculty, or at least he had I guess he was an instructor at MIT, but he was doing research in Cohn's lab. And in fact, quite a few of the people in Cohn's lab really had headquarters somewhere else, and were paid somewhere else.
Yeah.
But they came in and did work in his laboratory. And Onkley had developed apparatus for measuring dielectric properties of protein solutions, which could give it's quite a difficult experiment to make on an aqueous solution, but he'd solved a number of problems that had to be solved before such measurements could be made. And one could get some quite new information about protein molecules from this kind of measurement. So I did a number of experiments with Onkley's apparatus, and they turned out very well, and Dr. Cohn was very pleased.
Were these initiated by you or
no?
By Onkley.
By Cohn and Onkley. Mm. Cohn had the general idea that you could get something out of this, and Onkley provided the specific experimental details for getting these results. And we also had some technicians in the lab who did some of the routine work involved. By the way, these technicians wore white coats. We all wore white coats at the medical school. So
was this an exciting lab to work in?
It was exciting. Well, the whole Harvard community was enormously exciting because it was so intellectually stimulating. It was 10 times as stimulating as Stanford, although Stanford, of course, was enormously stimulating to me after I'd come from the backwoods.
Yeah. That's interesting. Would you say the same? It wouldn't be the same now.
It wouldn't be the same today because Stanford has developed enormously since I was there.
I see. It was a quite different place then.
It was, there were some very good people there, but there were only two members of the National Academy of Sciences at Stanford when I was there. And we were very much overshadowed by Berkeley. As students, this is going back in time a little. We were much as chemistry students at Stanford. we felt quite inferior to the chemistry department at Berkeley. Hmm. But Stanford students generally consider themselves as socially superior to, to people at Berkeley. Now, back to Boston. The second year, I had a half-time appointment in Cohn's lab, so now I was full-time. Mm-hmm. Toward the end, I continued working mostly on dielectric properties of proteins.
How old were you at this time?
Well, let's see, I was 25, I guess, something like that. Toward the end of my second year, however, Dr. Cohn decided he would nominate me for the Society of Fellows. I have to digress now to explain what this organization was. Abbot Lawrence Lowell, along with the other sweeping changes that he had made in Harvard education, establishment of the houses and the tutorial system, wanted to emulate another aspect of English, of one English university, and I think it's Christ Church College at Oxford, where the fellows of the college have no duties whatever. They are allowed to develop their intellectual interests as they choose, and their only duty is to attend dinner together. And by the way, in Oxford and Cambridge, in those days, people rarely bothered to get PhD degrees. Their letters were A B A M F R S. Their academic careers didn't include a PhD degree, and Lowell was rather annoyed with the idea that the PhD had to be a union card for an academic career in this country, and he tried to set up a scheme where it wouldn't be necessary by establishing the Society of Fellows, where people mostly of graduate student age would spend 3 years doing exactly what they wanted to. They'd have access to any Harvard department or any Harvard laboratory. All expenses would be paid. And then presumably at the end of this, they would be launched on a scientific career without a PhD. Dr. Cohn nominated me for this kind of appointment. I had slight misgivings because it meant a cut in salary. Actually, these people, like their opposite numbers in England, were very modestly paid, but of course it was a great honor, and it would give me a chance. I hadn't had any chance to get back to viscoelasticity, you see, and that was
and
the.
You were interested.
I was still more interested in viscoelasticity that I'd picked up in my PhD work than anything else. Mm-hmm. So I agreed. Well, I could hardly have said no to be nominated, and I had to be interviewed by a very distinguished group, which included Lowell and Alfred North Whitehead and John Livingston Lowes, the English scholar and the chairman of the society, was L.J. Henderson, whom I haven't mentioned until now. Cohn was his protege originally. Henderson was a man of remarkable intellect. Are you approaching the end of it?
I'm afraid I am.
Yes.
I brought another tape. This is tape 3 of the interview with John Ferry.
L.J. Henderson had been a chemist, then became a biochemist, and then a physiologist, and then a sociologist. But in the course of this career, he'd set up the Department of Physical Chemistry at the medical school, which I've described earlier, and then set up a large physiological laboratory, which was called the Fatigue Laboratory in the Harvard Business School, and then became interested in sociology, and in the last years of his life was devoted entirely to that discipline, although he maintained some interest in the laboratories that he had set up on the way. And since Cohn had been his protege and was very close to him, perhaps that helped my nomination for the Society of Fellows. I was a so-called junior fellow then of the Society of Fellows for 3 years. By the way, I'd said before that most of the fellows were graduate student age, but quite a few to begin with, like myself, already had their PhDs.
Mm-hmm.
A few people in those early days were successfully launched on their careers without PhDs, as Lowell had hoped would be the case. One of them was mathematician Garrett Birkhoff. Another was the historian Arthur Schlesinger, Jr. Mm. And another was a professor of English, Harry Levin. But after a couple of years, or after maybe 5 years, it became evident that this wasn't going to work. And so people in the Society of Fellows did get PhDs if they hadn't had them already when they became fellows.
What was the distinction between a junior fellow and a fellow?
The junior fellows were the fellows that I'm talking about. The senior fellows were a group of 5 or 6 grand old men, whose names I've already mentioned, who selected the junior fellows. The term fellow is confusing at Harvard because the Harvard Corporation that runs the university is called the President and Fellows. The fellows of the corporation are distinguished men of a professional or businessmen who run the university. Well, on Monday nights, we all had dinner, the junior and senior fellows together, and twice a week the junior fellows had lunch together. And these were the only, the attendance was of this, of these events was the only requirement.
Mm-hmm.
I continued for the first year pretty much as I had done before, working on things that Cohn was interested in. But then I did start some viscoelasticity experiments, and I found a technique with which I could measure viscoelastic properties of polymers and protein solutions by propagation of transverse waves. I won't go into the technical details.
How did you find it?
Oh, I don't really know what led to trying the experiment in the first place. However, my thinking was influenced by having worked with Onkley on dielectric properties, because there are properties which can be explained by complex variables. Again, I won't go into those details, but the voltage and current, alternating current, are in general out of phase, and by measuring the phase difference as a function of frequency, one can get important information. In the same way, I wanted to measure mechanical stress and strain in oscillating deformations where they would be out of phase, and measure the phase difference. This isn't very comprehensible.
Is this the wave?
Well, from the propagation of a wave, you can get this kind of information. I don't remember exactly how I came to the conclusion that this would be possible. There wasn't any really good theory about it at the time. The only place I went through all the literature, and the only place that I could find a theory that would help me a little was in a geophysical journal. Had to do with the propagation of waves in the earth, and geological waves. But toward the end, then, I was working to a large extent on propagation of waves, and since protein solutions are rather hard to deal with, they're unstable and so forth, I turned to solutions of a synthetic polymer. This was polystyrene. So I was getting back now to polymers that I'd been interested in my PhD work. And now that I had this fellowship, it didn't matter whether Dr. Cohn was interested in it or not, because I could work on whatever I chose to.
And you still worked in his lab.
His money bought me some equipment that I needed, although I scrounged around. I borrowed something from the General Radio Company, and I borrowed something from a professor of physics at MIT, so I didn't need very much in order to set up my equipment.
Was this the sort of thing that engaged you to the point that you were there until midnight? Or?
Oh, yes. Incidentally, back in London, a few months ago, I looked at my old diary and was somewhat surprised to find that quite often I would go out to the theater or to a party and then go back to the lab and work until 2 in the morning at the National Institute for Medical Research. Of course, I was the only person there in the whole building, probably, except for a watchman, because the English were not that dedicated to their work. To return then, as my fellowship. Oh, I'll make one other remark. During my junior fellowship, there was an opening at Stanford, where they wanted to appoint a faculty person in biochemistry. And of course, by this time I had acquired to some degree the label of a of a biochemist because of working at the medical school. And I probably could have had that position, but I didn't feel I was ready for it. I wanted to I wanted to develop with freedom of full-time work on research what I was doing, and I also wanted to spend some time abroad. That didn't pan out, as it turned out, because of the war, but so I passed up that opportunity.
You wanted it because you couldn't get the enough training here.
If I'd gone back to Stanford, I would have.
I mean, you wanted to go abroad because you'd. The labs were more advanced there.
I think it was more because I wanted the experience of of another trip abroad.
Yeah,
to tell you the truth. I don't think it would have helped my training particularly. Well, maybe we better stop now. It's been more than an hour.
All right.
And now we're ready to talk about war work.
All right. Yeah.